in the hearing, Ms. Scott, before we hear from your design guideline team, I have one question that I would be grateful if you could respond to. Mr. Devlin's evidence appears to be premised on the basis that we have jurisdiction to amend a document incorporated by reference. And I'm interested as to the legal basis for that view, because as I read part three of the first schedule, I'm not sure it's correct.
Certainly. Look, when a document's incorporated by reference, it includes an additional step of the process, which is the requirement to consult on the document that is intended to be incorporated by reference. As Mr. Blair has acknowledged in the section 42A, that step was essentially missed, and the document was then incorporated by reference and went out for submissions. In terms of Mr. Blair's recommendations to...
I think you mean Mr. Devlin.
Sorry, Mr. Devlin. Mr. Devlin's recommendations to amend the guidelines, that is in response to advice from me to do that. In my submission, when a document is incorporated by reference, it is to be treated as if it is part of the district plan. It's therefore notified in the same way that the rest of the change is notified, and in my submission can be subject to submissions seeking changes. That's the approach we took in earlier stages where design guides were incorporated into the plan, for example, the Arrowtown design guide, and in my submission the same approach applies here.
The reason why I queried you is that I'm reading clause 32, which says material may be incorporated by reference in a plan in whole or in part and with modifications, additions or variations specified in the plan or the proposed plan, which makes it sound to me that if, take a completely different example, if the plan were to incorporate by reference a relevant New Zealand standard, the plan, based on clause 30, could also say, we incorporate by reference NZSX, save that in some respect, we're not going to do that. But that suggests that if there's going to be an amendment to the plan from what was the document incorporated by reference, the differences need to be on the face of the plan, not just amending the document incorporated by reference. So that was the line of thinking I went down. So basically, tell me why that's wrong.
Yes, so clause 32, that is about what is notified. So at the point of notification, you can incorporate a document by reference. And if, for example, you have a technical set of guidelines that might apply around New Zealand, then your plan can specify as part of the provisions changes that you might want to make to it. That in my submission is the purpose of clause 32, subclause 1. In this situation, we have a Queenstown Lake specific design guide. It's notified to be part of the plan. It's to take effect as if it was a rule. And I can't see any reason why we would ignore the ability to make submissions on that document and seek changes to it. It's a guideline that's specific to Queenstown. It's not going to be incorporated into any other plan around New Zealand, which distinguishes it from things like some New Zealand guidance on noise or something like that. So in my submission, clause 32 is about the notified step of the process. And if we couldn't seek changes to that document through submissions, I'd question the point of even having a public process on the notification of the design guides.
Well, I'll come to that question, but I read next clause 31, which says amendment to or replacement of material incorporated by reference in a plan or proposed plan has legal effect only if, in effect, you restart the process of consultation and then public notification. And like, it's the particular bit I'm concerned about is where it says legal effect as part of a proposed plan. So it was clearly notified as part of a proposed plan, and clause 31 seems to be saying an amendment to that can only be undertaken by restarting the process. Now, and possibly the answer to the rhetorical question you put to me might be that's the purpose of the special consultative procedure, that if you're going to incorporate documents by reference, you obtain the views of the community before you notify the plan, and then so that might suggest you don't that's the reason why you don't exhibit or expose the underlying document to submission. You only expose what you're proposing to do with it in your plan. Now, as I say, that's the line of thinking. I'm not saying it's cast iron. I've talked, and I'm not saying it's my idea either. Commissioner Munro asked me this question, which set various rabbits running in my mind.
Two responses to that. I have looked, and there's no case law on this particular issue, so it's not something that the courts have considered. The first point is that the process to, or the requirement to go and consult prior to notification of the PDP is a relatively flexible requirement. There's no timeframes in the RMA. There's nothing in here that gives a really clear direction to a council on how it should undertake that consultation. In terms of what it needs to do with that, any feedback it receives is also quite general. The council's not prescribed by other, parts of the plan, section 32, and parts of the RMA about preparing a plan when it considers that feedback. So in my submission, the ability to consider submissions on the guidelines and hear them is a far more fair process to work through. The second point is clause 31. My submission is the purpose of that clause is to make it clear that when you incorporate a document by reference, you can't, and it gets changed through another, for example, local government process, that just doesn't automatically become part of the plan, because that would essentially be a plan change by stealth. And that is something that has been grappled with by the courts, and they've made it very clear that if you are going to incorporate a document by reference and you want to change it, then you need to go through a plan change process in the future. For example, with Arrowtown, the 2006 guidelines were part of the plan, and the council had to go through a variation to bring in the 2016 guidelines. If we think outside the square a little bit, and we were incorporating by reference a national technical document, and it's not owned by the council, for example, the government might go through a change to it. If the council wants to bring those changes into its plan, it would need to go through a plan change process for the new technical document to take legal effect?
Okay, I think I'm grateful for that response. Early curveball in the day. Commissioner Munro, do you want to take it up any further?
Yes, thanks. I've got a couple of questions of you. But as someone who sat on that variation one process, what muddies that, if you wish to use that as an example to rely on for this process, is that the council, in its 32A report, its expert evidence, and its 42A report, at no time made reference to the by reference provisions, and treated the guideline effectively as if it was just a standalone chapter of the plan. There were some aspects of your counsel, your arguments, that talked about incorporation. But in its recommendation report, the panel specifically found that it had been treated as if it was just part of the plan and suggested it actually had been approached that way by the council. Council still has it on its website right now as a by-reference document, so no one's trying to suggest the council had a different idea, but the distinction, I think, that variation one had to this process is that the council didn't make anything like the attention that's put in this process or the stream on the by-reference provisions and that consultative step. For whatever consequence that has, who knows?
Can I respond to that comment, observation? The reason why the council's been a lot clearer on this is that it was critiqued during the Arrowtown process as to not being clear enough.
Yeah. So the questions I have for you specific to this document is, in terms of the changes proposed to the residential and mixed-use zones, there's addition of a new policy in each of the relevant zones to the effect of encourage things to be consistent with the new guideline. Can we take from the proposed addition of those policies that the council didn't think the guidelines could be justified as hanging off the existing policies that are already in the plan?
I think that might be a question that Mr. Devlin can answer.
That's fine. I will get to Mr. Yeah. Devlin later then. Where I wanted to go with you was the policy in all cases uses the word encourage.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think the limits of encourage are, specifically as it relates to the council's ability to compel people to do something they don't want to do?
Is that question in the context of a resource consent?
Yeah. So legally, if the key policy is encourage, and the council's asked someone to do something, and that person says no, what are the limits of what the council can do when implementing its encouragement?
Well, it depends on the activity status to start with. So, for example, if the activity status is RDA, it's a matter of discretion. It's something that the council can take into account. It could decline a consent based on that matter of discretion. It would need to be, it would need to look at the objectives and policies, of course, before it did that, as to the direction, which takes you to the question of the word encourage. Encourage is not I'd submit it doesn't imply a mandatory requirement. It can't require an outcome to be forced.
Hence my question of, although the proposed restrictions just say consistency with the guideline, if the method is implementing a policy that only goes as far as encourage, can the council actually refuse consent? If in all other respects an application merited the granting of consent, the only issue was the guideline?
Well, I would say, this is contextual, but I would say it couldn't decline consent, but it could impose conditions.
Yes. So then the question I'm going to ask you is, do you know why the council didn't seem to consider whether or not this requirement should be a controlled activity, not a restricted discretionary activity?
I don't know the answer to that, no.
Okay. I don't have any other questions for you in terms of legal questions or the position of the council. Okay. Mm.
I suggest you might want to put that same question
that
to Mr. Devlin.
Well, I think Mr. Devlin said in his evidence he didn't do the Section 32 report.
That's correct.
No, but he might be able to assist you just with the question more generally
maybe.
About
okay.
activity status.
Commissioner Smith, any questions from Ms. Scott?
I think they might be best addressed to Mr. Devlin, but I might just start off on something. Am I to presume that these guidelines effectively become de facto assessment matters for discretionary and restricted discretionary activities?
Yes, they're not called assessment matters. They actually replace assessment matters in the in some relevant chapters. In terms of, it's what we call, that they are slightly different to an assessment matter, so I wouldn't say conclusively yes. They are something that the council can take into consideration where listed in any specific rule. So it needs to be, for an RDA rule, it needs to be listed there as a matter of discretion before you can turn to them. If it's a fully discretionary activity, then well, the council can look at anything it likes in any event.
So for there to be a strong connection in the plan for a, say, restricted discretionary activity, the policies would need to direct you towards the guidelines in the first place, or is it to say that you were trying to achieve a certain outcome, and that there might be an assessment matter that sits underneath that, or a matter of discretion that requires you to have regard to the design guidelines, and then the design guidelines would sit underneath that as a reference document. Is that how I understand it?
Yeah, that's correct. Yes, so the objectives and policies should always sit above and set out the framework for the rules that sit below it.
Okay, and I'll just, we can cover up some of this stuff off later with Mr. Devlin, but I just was reflecting on the three parks special zone, for instance, and it is of relevance because part of that zone is now becoming business mixed use, so that the policies that sat in the three park special zone no longer sit there because it's been the new zoning is a mixed use business zone. So we are now reliant on policies and directions that used to sit within the three park special zone that will now sit within the mixed use zone. Do you understand that link?
So if it's a business mixed use zone anywhere in the district, the new policy that's been notified would be there.
Yeah.
If your question is whether the new three parks zone, commercial or business, which we'll come to later today, or commercial and business, this variation doesn't apply to that zone.
No, that's my point. And that the three park special zone, for instance, had quite a complex array of policies relating to design outcomes, including sustainability and pedestrianisation or mixed use spaces. The direction, the complexity of the policy in the three park special zone basically was trying to inform the same outcomes as what we're trying to achieve through the design guidelines in terms of urban design. That they're probably two. In one example, that's very heavy in the policy end, in the policies and objectives in the plan, and in this case, it's very. We've gone to the other extreme, and we're putting this into a reference document that sits outside the policies. So I'm just interested in the impact that has on, I suppose, which is the preferred approach. And obviously you're promoting the reference document one, but are we throwing out the complexity that is in the, sorry, I'm off track. Are we losing some of the value of those policies by discarding them in favour of this approach?
No.
No, okay. We can explore that a bit later, I think, and I'll use some specific examples, but I think there's some really interesting direction that the policies have provided in other cases.
Sure. Mr. Roberts is here and he would have listened to that discussion, so we can catch up on that later.
Yeah, thank you.
Commissioner Dawson?
No.
Mr. Hill?
One for me. I got a bit of thing about climate change. It's not a bee in my crop. 104E was, Section 104E of the Act was repealed just recently, which is applicable to rates of discharge of greenhouse gases.
Sorry, what's that?
Section 104E of the RMA was repealed last week.
Just hold that thought. Do you know what is in the transition rules of that Act? Has it even been signed off by the Governor-General yet?
I'm not sure where the question's heading, but I...
I'm working around to it.
Yeah, but I think the answer may be, yes, it was appealed, but no, that doesn't affect this process, I suspect.
Repealed.
Oh, repealed. Appealed. Yes and yes.
What's that?
I agree with what you just said.
That... I think there's a transition provision, Commissioner, in the Amendment Act that has just been passed that says we continue under the old rules.
I can speak to that. Assuming there's no change in the Act that came out late last week, in the bill there was a 2-year transition period. And the purpose of that transition period is to allow the government to catch up in preparing the national climate change, so the emission reductions plan, and I can't recall the name of the other one, because they need to come into place before, for example, preparing a plan can take them into account. They don't exist at the moment. The only space where there isn't a transition is for national projects which are directly referred to the Environment Court, I think.
There you go. And there was, because I traversed this a bit in a hearing recently, but there's a section of the Act that deals with specifically with climate, you know, have regard with climate change.
Yes.
But that's, my understanding is, a question to you, is that's specifically to do with impacts on sea level rise and being aware of sea level rise, and I was just wondering if there's any case law that looks at specific climate change and climate change emissions that we could have regard to or do have regard.
There is. So the what section 7 requires is that decision makers have to have regard to effects of climate change. So where that kicks in is, for example, if someone is looking to do an activity within the coastal environment and there's a requirement there to consider the impact of, as you say, sea level rise, erosion, that type of thing, on the particular activity in question. Stepping away from that, the courts, and this is through solid energy litigation, have confirmed that there is no requirement to consider the effects on climate change of an activity. So that is on the RMA as it currently stands, so without the amendments that have just been made to it because of the transitional delay that I just spoke about. So the only exception to that is if you are considering an activity that will have... I wasn't prepared to talk to this morning. the only exception to that is... activities to do with renewable generation, and in that situation you can consider effects on climate change. Obviously not something relevant to Queenstown Lakes.
Thank you, Ms. Scott. we'll proceed on the assumption that that we have scope to amend the design guidelines. I should tell you that I'm going to ask the same question to Narrabah Hill when they rock in and see what answer they give me, and then we'll see what we can see. But for present purposes, I think the best way forward is to assume that that is correct, so we get the assistance of your witnesses on the substance, and then we'll decide if there's a technical problem.
Certainly. Mr. Devlin has some corrections to make to his evidence. So just starting there, Mr. Devlin's prepared two statements, Section 42A report dated 18th of March and rebuttal evidence dated 12 June. If you could just take the panel through those corrections, I'll pass the microphone to you.
Good morning, Commissioners. Just four corrections to my Section 42A report. Subsequently, become aware of in preparing for this hearing. If I can ask you to turn to page 8. The four policies quoted at the top of page 8, and just the numbering reference is incorrect on the last one. It should be 4.2.2.9. Second change is page 9, paragraph 5.5. If you could please strike through the second sentence. And just to explain there, it wasn't until I considered the evidence of Mr. Brown, Jeffrey Brown, that I realised the difference in the wording just in the how to use the guidelines. And so there is actually no design statement for the BMU. So that was an error, that second sentence. Page 14, if you could delete paragraph 7.7, you'll note it was unfinished because it was moved to another part of the report, and that paragraph can be deleted.
So that was which paragraph?
7.7. On page 14. And the final change was just that in that section numbered 7, which is topic 3, the numbering goes haywire, unfortunately. I've had a few problems with this. So if you are referring to a paragraph in section 7, if you could please just also refer to the page number, because there's quite a few 7.1s.
Is this the point for a ritual bow in the direction of Microsoft DHQ?
Yes.
We'll take responsibility for
that. Is this section 7?
Yeah, mine's
section 7. Mine looks nice, fine.
Mine's good.
Is it? Okay.
Well, it's good last time, but it's good
this miracles of words.
I did have two versions of this report. And
yes.
Oh, yep.
This is the second version.
This is the later one, I think.
Oh, okay. Oh, maybe that's not a correction then.
Looks like you've been blessed by the planning fairy.
Yeah. So I'll just read my short summary and then hand over to Mr. Compton Mine for the same. The QLDC has chosen to prepare design guidelines for the residential zones, low, medium and high density, and for the business mixed use zone. Both design guidelines set out 12 design elements that promote good design principles. The design guidelines are to be incorporated by reference into the PDP. They are incorporated into the policies and rules of the relevant zones, and in the case of the business mixed use zone design guidelines, also into the district wide chapter 31 signs. I have assessed and made recommendations on the submissions received on the two design guidelines and the associated variations. A total of 26 original submissions and 8 further submissions were received. A number of changes have been made to address issues raised in submissions, including greater emphasis on guidance for sloping sites through both changes to sketches and photographs, extra descriptive text to the status of the guidelines section to clarify the role of the guidelines, amendments to the design statement stage for the residential design guidelines, a number of other small changes to better improve the effectiveness and accuracy of the design guidelines. The key outstanding matters of disagreement between myself and submitters who have filed evidence are whether the residential design guidelines are necessary, and whether the residential design guidelines introduce additional matters beyond the matters of discretion, including matters that are not listed as standards in the zone in question. I consider the residential design guidelines are necessary and help achieve and implement the objectives and policies of the three residential chapters of the PDP, including those identified in the Section 32 and Section 42A reports for the strategic directions chapters. I consider my recommended amendments to the status of the guidelines section clarifies that they provide examples and not intended to be assessed in terms of compliance, but rather whether the proposals address the good design elements promoted by the design guidelines, and they do acknowledge that alternative approaches may be suitable. I note that the residential design guidelines have been specifically added into the policies of the residential chapters and therefore apply to any proposal that is covered by the objectives and policies, including discretionary and non-complying activities. Under a fully discretionary consent, such as for boundary setbacks in some residential zones, the design guidelines and the design elements can be considered. They have also been specifically added as a matter of discretion to resource consents that have an activity status of restricted discretionary. I consider my recommended extra wording added into the status of the guidelines section, which states that they are not to be used to assess compliance, recognises that only the relevant part of the residential design guidelines need to be considered under a restricted discretionary consent application. For all other submissions, I consider the notified PDP provisions are more appropriate.
So I'm Dave Compton-Mullen, I'm a director of DCM Urban. I was one of the principal authors of the design guides with Mr. Devlin and Ms. Quinn of Vivian Espy. We worked on the design guides from 2018 to 2019, mid-2019, and then we made some minor changes following submission for March 2020. Those range from fixing small typos through the updating some of the cross-links to policies. We clarified that the guides do not apply to limited activities, clarified that the guides are for reference as opposed to being assessed against good compliance. We updated some of the photos so they had more Queenstown relevance in Wanaka. We updated the cross-referencing, as I mentioned. We deleted some of the text in the business mixed use guide to allow greater freedom for residential activities on the ground floor, but still having some measure of control. Updating the planting palette, and additional information was added regarding sloping size. No changes were made to address submissions seeking to limit the business mixed use guide to certain activities. The design guide for business mixed use recognises there will be some functional requirements for certain activities within the zone, which may render it difficult to achieve the desired built outcome. But we considered that it was important that the design process for any activity starts through the application of the design guide with creating a built form which has a strong built relationship to the street. And overall, I consider that the design guides are an appropriate and positive tool to assist development in Queenstown Lakes District without being overly prescriptive or simply duplicating the standards and rules that are outlined in the PDP chapters.
Thank you, gentlemen. We'll treat you as a tag team, so whatever questions are asked, then probably if you want to sort out who answers first and then the other chips in, I don't mind either way, as long as you're vaguely consistent. If you're not, that might be a problem. Commissioner Munro, would you like to go first?
Okay. Appreciate you're both heavily involved in authoring the guidelines document. Who authored the plant provisions proposed?
They were authored by council officers in the Section 32 report.
Question was lobbed to you earlier about if the intent is encouragement and maybe conditions, not requirement and refusal. Why wasn't a controlled activity considered?
Yeah, I just quickly quickly check the chapters, and there's very few controlled activities in those three residential zones. For example, the only controlled activity seems to be residential visitor accommodation.
Okay.
Yeah, so there are few controlled activities in the four zones that they cover.
So I'm just looking at the policies, for instance, of the medium residential zone. And it may well be that there aren't many controlled activities because there are very few policies that say encourage. They say ensure, provide, encourage on sites, low impact stormwater design, avoid, provide. So is there another reason other than that the existing policy framework didn't lead to controlled activities that was considered?
Is there a reason why there's not more controlled activities?
No, I've got to put it another way. Your answer that there aren't many controlled activities in the plan might not be very helpful because there aren't many policies currently that use the word encourage, and so there might be a clear and obvious reason why the plan doesn't have many controlled activities that might not really help justify for this new matter whether test is encouragement. A controlled activity might not have been considered. So is there another reason in your mind that you might put to us? If not,
another reason for
why a controlled activity wasn't considered. It's unusual for a council to seek to encourage something and then implement that by giving itself the ability to refuse things on the basis of more of a compulsion or requirement. If that's not what the council seeks to do.
I think it was a deliberate policy decision to encourage rather than ensure, just to recognise that there's multiple ways of multiple design responses, and the design guidelines don't pretend to be the be all and end all. That I guess the focus is on encouraging those design principles to be looked at.
Okay, so if a restriction of discretion as a legal instrument is effectively like a window within which a council can consider issues, and the council's view to us is that it's still very much thinking that it's about encouraging these guidelines, not trying to require anything or what have you. Would we have the ability to simply refine the way the restriction of discretion is worded so that it's clearer that the council will use the restriction to encourage things, not force things?
Yes, I think the panel could choose to do that. Yes.
Okay. You both, in your summaries, touched on the importance of clarifying that not every single element needs to be considered, and it's not a by rote type process, and it's about identifying what's relevant. Who decides that?
Obviously, there'd be some context in terms of the development, and then it would be the processing plan.
So the council decides what element to remember.
Yes, but I'm hoping common sense would take the fore, and so obviously, depending on that development, it would be quite straightforward to see what aspects are relevant. Mm. Obviously, if you were looking at a height breach, you wouldn't look at what you're doing in terms of the storage of waste bins. You'd actually just be looking at using the guide to address how you deal with that high bridge.
Okay. We were very helpfully provided with a list of sites and developments to visit as part of our site visits, demonstrating a variety of the elements. Who identified those for us? Were you both involved in that process?
Yes.
Yep. And we were also provided with a little table that went through what you thought they did well and what maybe could have been done differently. Were you involved in that summary document?
I wasn't.
Well, I wasn't expecting that answer, I have to say. All right, well, that might significantly limit any weighting we might put on that commentary if it's not from the witnesses that are actually talking to us about it. But you're familiar with the sites we visited? Reiterate that?
Yes, broadly, yeah. No, I'm just looking at the, you know, as we call it, the...
That's okay, I'm just trying to figure out what's actually evidence and what's something else.
Yeah, this was provided in response to the panel minute, and it was prepared by council officers, I think.
Okay. Look, I'm gonna go out here and say that's helping you guys, because I really struggled with some of those sites to see what you were talking about based on what I thought your evidence was saying and what the guidelines were. So let's just say let's leave it where it is. But one of the things that struck me on our site visits, particularly some of the residential visits, and I'd prefer not to unnecessarily name them, was that there were some issues that seemed to stand out at me that weren't in the guideline. For instance, when we visited some of the specific dwellings that we were drawn to, what struck me as interesting was not so much the dwelling, but that for about 20 dwellings either side, it was actually the exact same dwelling with the exact same colours and the exact same layout over and over and over and over and over again. And the existing zones already have policies talking about variation in building design, variation in layout, variation and all of those things. And so it really begs the question, how did you go about identifying the elements that are in the guide and what informed them?
So it's very much the guide is at the level of a site-specific development rather than a wider subdivision development. It's very much looking at individual lots.
Okay. Do you think that's sufficiently clear for users of the guideline? For instance, they often have photographs showing roads and streets that I wouldn't expect an applicant to design if they're just doing a single lot development.
Potentially there's aspects in there that they would, you know, with the high density in particular and medium density, there are aspects where that they may have an internal road or a laneway or how they deal with their parking.
Yes. And so that goes back to my first question, because most medium density developments in particular start with a large site and a land use consent to figure out all of those built form issues and internal streets, and then a subdivision comes along later. And so I'm trying to understand the decision making process to provide guidance for some things like internal streets, but not other things like maybe don't design 30 houses that are all identical.
So with the medium density, if they were developing a block, intention that this design guide actually was, if there was a lot within that development that allowed for 4 or 5 dwellings or more, that's when the design guide would be, that's where the focus is, rather than on that, the design of the total block.
So if someone sought consent for 40 units, which triggers the 4 or more unit requirement, and they bring to council a guideline and say, you've got no basis to tell us anything that you don't like about our design that's not in the guideline.
Happens? Yeah, so if it was one developer who came in with that 40, I imagine they'd be treated as that one entity. The example we've given with, you know, say, one of the housing developments where you've got that repetition, we would probably find that each one came in on an individual consent application.
Yep.
And so that would have been the only opportunity to...
Yes. So a single lot on a single subdivided site is probably a permitted activity. So I'm not focused on those. I'm focused on someone needing consent under the framework of the plan for multiple units on site. The guideline gives them guidance on how to design the internal street, but stays silent on pretty much everything else. And so would that applicant then be able to say, but you haven't raised these issues in your design guideline, therefore they're not relevant?
I think it does raise it in terms of providing variation and diversity.
Yeah. Okay. We'll get to that on a page-by-page basis. But thank you for that. So one of the questions I also asked earlier was about whether the introduction of the new policies to the residential zones and the mixed-use zone was indicative that the guideline wasn't really focused on the existing policies. Now, I appreciate in the evidence, Mr. Devlin, you've gone through and sought to draw connections where you think the elements of the guideline are relevant to matters raised, and the guideline does talk about those. But is the guideline primarily there because of the new policy, or is it there to deal with the issues raised by the existing policies?
So
guidelines there to assist implementation of the existing policies. There's quite a strong focus now on design in the zones, and also in the strategic directions and urban development chapters 3 and 4. So yeah, the PDP has a much stronger focus on design matters compared to the ODP.
Very good. And for instance, when I look at mixed use zone policy 16.2.2.1, I don't know if you've got that
hand. Say that number again, please.
16.2.2.1.
Yes.
And of all the many versions that are floating out there, if you've got the same one I had, it starts with the word require and then goes on about the design of buildings positively contributing to visual quality by providing active and articulated building frontages. So that policy seems to say the council should be looking at requiring things like active building frontages. But because the guideline's been imposed under the framework of a policy that says encourage, the content of the guideline often says things like encourage active frontages, even though there are policies in the plan that say require it. And so I've got a question about whether, by trying to take a softly approach with the content of the guideline, the council might actually be undermining the policies rather than supporting them by suggesting a lower bar might be actually in play. And so, for instance, if we look at page 11, point E of the updated mixed-use guideline, that specifically says encourage active frontages. And so the question really then I put to you is across the wording in particular, are you satisfied you've got the right balance of maybe we need to think about the policy that's saying encourage consistency with the guidelines is about the administration of the guidelines and how heavy-handed the council might be, but maybe the actual wording in the guideline could better reflect the existing policies that maybe don't take such a hands-off approach to design. And that's probably a comment I'd say might exist across both guidelines, but I don't want to do a line-by-line with you. That would probably take 2 days. Is that something you'd accept or agree with, or am I wrong?
I think it's a valid point. Obviously the policy to require is not changing. It's can be treated as as far as policies can, it can be treated as operative.
That's a concern in my mind, is that applicants use the guideline against the council and say, but surely the council meant something like what's in the guideline, and it's more of an encouragement, and maybe the policy that says require shouldn't be taken so literally. And that might not help council's consent plan as much if that's not what the policy intends.
Yeah, I think that's a risk that we need to be aware of, yes.
I noticed sometimes, in many instances, the images used have some interpretive help, like a tick or a cross. But in other cases, the photos don't. Is there a reason for that, or not?
So I think all the photos have ticks or crosses.
Do they?
Are you referring to the diagrams?
No. I'm looking at page 6 of the business mixed use guideline, and I'm seeing 4 photographs, but I don't know whether they're what sort, what's not sort. And I'm not sure a user would either. For instance.
So on these pages there, just to give a feel for the, I guess, the scale and the bulk of development in the business next use.
Do you think that should be made clear so that people understand what they're actually being asked to do and what's purely informational and what's actually something the council's planners might be interested in? Or is it a case of, in our mind's eye, we just imagine all these have ticks on them, they don't otherwise have anything on them?
This particular section is like an introduction to the following design elements where they are all ticked or crossed. So It's kind of an overview section of the BMU
zone.
So I think with the design elements, it's important to have the tick or the cross.
Right. So can you go to page 7 of the mixed use guide, and in the top middle photo, looks to me like a detached house. It doesn't seem to have any visible doors or windows at the ground floor, and seems to not do a whole bunch of things elements elsewhere say you should do. If an applicant came along with a plan or design based on this and said to the council, but we took it from your guideline, is it your view that the council would say, well, that doesn't count because it's the explanatory part, not the actual guideline part?
Potentially, that could be part of the answer.
Okay. I noticed across both guidelines, and I'll use that image as an example, you've used images in both. So that image of whatever that is also in the residential guideline. Do you think that weakens the power of the images when the council's suggesting it's high density mixed use as well as reasonably modest density residential?
In this example, there's actually an office on the ground floor. It's hard to tell obviously in that photo. But what it does promote is good built design, built form. Obviously built right up to the street edge, it's got good street presence, which can happen in both. In all zones. And also, I imagine there is an expectation. We're really looking at the built form,
That's helpful. So following on from that, though, people assessing a resource consent that might not have anybody in this room who's having this conversation involved don't know that. They just see a photograph that the council is endorsing as a good example of what sort. So the question is, should the photos have some kind of caption or limiting statement where if there are specific things that you're looking to recognise but not other things that can be made clear, so that people don't misuse the images to specifically show the things you're not trying to illustrate, but which the photos still show, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
Where they actually pick photos from different elements and start mixing them around, which I've seen people do with guidelines, unfortunately.
No, I think it would be helpful, obviously, when we're playing together, is trying to keep it as simple as possible.
Yeah.
But I agree, it's always hard to find the perfect example as well, because most governments have some flaw, and a lot of good stuff as well.
Look, it's always a tension with guidelines where the one shoots for the stars and shows the best possible outcomes, knowing people will then say it's idealistic, it isn't real, or whether you do the pragmatic compromises that then people criticise because they say you could have done better or asked for better. So that's just an editorial decision we've made, I think. If we go just on that topic, though, so we go back to page 6 of the mixed use guide, and we reflect on the Scott's comments to us that by reference these effectively get treated as though they're part of the plan. But the zones already have descriptions, so what does this add to the plan? And if necessary, should you just be quoting the description that's in the plan rather than perhaps creating a second sort of explanation?
I think you did right that the zone does have a purpose statement at the start, and a lot of this is possibly repeating that. However, I do feel as a standalone document that's incorporated by reference, it does also need a bit of needs to stand on its own 2 feet and be readable as a separate document as well. Potentially, that cross reference to the district plan purpose statement could replace that section, but will it get looked at? I'm not sure. So I think it's still the balance between being a standalone document that people could pick up and read, or is that council reception?
Okay. Okay, understand that. The glossary that's proposed at the back of that guideline, and there's a much, much shorter glossary in the residential guideline, but I'm not going to ask you why one is quite expensive and one isn't, but have you checked and are you satisfied that the definitions proposed there don't conflict with or otherwise sit unevenly with any definition? definitions of like or similar or identical terms that are actually in the plan already?
No.
Okay. And it may be they're all unique design terms. I actually object. So when I look at page 5 of the mixed use guide, and it has those 5 steps. When the council is considering whether an applicant has been consistent with the guidelines, if they hadn't sought advice or consulted with the council, which is step 5, would that be evidence that the guidelines haven't been used? Because if the test is consistency with the guidelines and this document says you should be seeking advice and consulting council, and someone doesn't do that, is that a problem?
No, it's not a problem. People can choose not to have a prayer meeting and not discuss it with council.
Okay, so just help me work through it. They've got to do step 3, which is all about the design elements. They don't have to do step 5.
Yeah, I think the key is the words for further clarification or advice, so it's kind of implying it's an optional extra. So if you've read the design guidelines and worked through steps 1 to 4, but you're stuck on how to deal with one particular component, you could seek further clarification or advice.
I'm interested in step 5 because Mr. Compton-Mullen said before he felt it would be the council that decides what of the elements are relevant. And that if there's a bit of a scrap between an applicant and council staff, which I know it sounds extraordinary, but it might happen, about whether something's relevant or not, does the council turn to this page and say, well, you should have done it properly by coming and seeing us beforehand, and we could have told you then what we think is relevant, and you could have designed it the way we're telling you to design it, etc. But you're sure step 5 isn't going to be picked on by staff as part of what they think applicants need to be consistent with?
Yes, I believe so. Because I think the council will understand that they can't force anyone to do pre-application or contact them about a proposal.
Okay. I want to ask a number of questions about the images. Specifically, because whereas I'm a trained designer, so I look at them in a certain way, but my colleagues maybe focus a lot more on the words. If I turn to page 10 of the mixed use guideline, and I look at the bottom of the 3 images, other than that it's telling me that that's a staircase, what is that actually telling me?
It's just a nice level of detailing, and it's of a human scale.
What is it that gives it a human scale?
Just the variety and the proportions.
Right. Because when I read the grey box with white font, that doesn't mention any of the things you've just told me. That talks about entrances addressing a street, active frontages, having doors and glazing that photo doesn't have, etc. Is that the best photo, do you think?
It clearly defines an entrance.
Do people need a guideline to know, though, that what a staircase looks like?
You'd be surprised. some of the designs I see come through, they have the staircase or the main entrance will be well hidden.
Okay. Page 16. Are there any requirements of the district plan for communal open spaces or amenities to be delivered? And does this become a de facto standard where the council starts asking applicants to start providing them?
No, there's no specific rules requiring provision of those matters, but it, we felt it was something that in a design process should be considered.
So if an applicant doesn't provide or propose any communal space, but the council staff feel they should, and therefore say the element is relevant, does that mean the applicant would need to provide a communal open space to demonstrate consistency with the guidelines?
I think there would be a discussion, debate to be had around council's view that that was required versus the applicant's view that it wasn't, and that
okay.
would have to be resolved.
The communal open space is an interesting issue for me because it's probably the only element that I can't see any support for in any of the policies of the plan. And so on this issue, instead of the guideline and elements helping illustrate what those other things might mean, this seems to be standing out as its own uniquely new requirement. Well, requirement's a strong word, I'll take that back. Topic for discussion. And it seems to me that it's out on a bit of a limb. Look, I absolutely understand where it's come from, Mr. Comptonmo. That sounds like a dentist to set up. So I guess I'm going to ask you, can you point me to any of the existing policies in the relevant, well, the mixed-use zone that could support the council chasing after a communal open space?
Just to note, it's not strictly just communal open space. Design element 5 talks about where sites adjoin open spaces, and there is a specific discussion or there's a specific rule on that matter. I can't quite recall if there's an objective in policy for the business mixed-use zone in relation to Horn Creek.
Yeah, no, there's one paragraph that talks about adjoining existing open spaces, but the balance of the topic and its own heading is to create public and communal open spaces, not about having a neighbour that's open space. And so I'm not sure that's got to address the question. But yes, fair enough. Part of it does maybe address that issue of the planning requirement for adjoining an open space.
Yes, Mr. Compton-Miles is pointing me to 16.2.2.4.
Hold on. Let's just find that.
16.2.2.4. Which isn't what you were raising it, it's more what
no,
I was
that's
raising
talking about utilising linking with open spaces nearby, not about providing new ones.
Yes.
Okay, look, I've raised the question and you've given me what answer you could.
Yeah, I think you're correct that there isn't a strong policy direction or rule requirement to create communal open spaces.
Do you think that it might be more appropriate if this element were to survive that it be recast to the circumstances where an applicant was going to propose a communal open space or public open space, then here's some ideas of how to go about it, rather than perhaps falling into that regulatory grey space.
Yes, and I think that would address
okay.
some of the submitted concerns as well.
I want to go to the diagram on page 19. On, it's also raised in some of the photos, page 18 and elsewhere, is that a lot of what's being shown there is a street of some kind. Has the council ever consented a land use consent to create a new street without at the same time consenting a subdivision to allow the street to be vested, do you know?
Yeah, I think you're right. Normally it would be a subdivision and land use consent, and addressed at the time of subdivision, but we did wonder just about Jack's point, where all the roads are actually private. Also just to note, in, for example, on page 18, the photograph in the middle on the right hand side is looks like a street, but it's actually outside the New World in Frankton.
Okay, thank you.
And also the left hand side column photo is a laneway in Arrowtown.
Yeah, so back to page 19 then. When I looked at the diagram and I read point E, my first response was, surely the council can put whatever furniture in its own roads it wants to. And why would an applicant be asked to furnish the council's roads as part of a consent for something on its own site? And I think part of the answer is my confusion that Mr. Compton-Mullen sort of helped earlier, which was it's sort of the guides are sort of premised on a lot, an individual site or lot basis, but then what happens on a big site where you might be putting new streets in?
So something like, although they're not the zones covered here, but something like Remarkables Park or Five Mile, they have their internal road network and they're all private, not council vested roads, and so they would, you know, could potentially do their own street furniture and that sort of thing.
Yep, okay. So this is more about private streets and lanes. Thank you. Page 26. No, let's go to page 22 first. The photograph shown across, it's got the lovingly personalised rubbish bins. That photo is also in the residential guideline. It's a residential site, I think. Is it fair to put that in a mixed use zone guideline? It doesn't seem to represent the land uses or building forms that are being sought.
True, but I think it was a good example that they had, during the design process, they hadn't thought about waste storage.
Sure.
And that's the point we're trying to get across.
Okay.
It was an afterthought.
What's the leftmost photograph above the grey box with the tick on it? It's the mesh door. What is it?
It's a storage facility. It's roughly, I guess, 2 cubic metres where they can put bikes, materials. It's by the front door of a medium density.
Because to someone who doesn't know where it's from, all you're showing them is to put a mesh door in. Do you think that'd be fair?
Yes.
Okay. Page 26 then. With a comment that I hope will be free of any judgment from those in the room, I've frequented the Botswana Butchery venue several times, and so I knew it straight away. Is it in the mixed use zone?
No.
Do you think that there's a risk that when the council's discussing with applicants some of the illustrations that are shown as good examples, do you think applicants might be able to short-circuit some of that by simply saying, but those photos are from different zones with different rules, they don't apply, they're not relevant?
Where possible, we've tried to use photos from a particular zone, but we've also got photos from outside of Queenstown.
The landscape palette, I suppose, at the end, the species, to what extent do they relate to or be compatible with or otherwise the palette, if any, that the council uses in its reserves and roads?
When we prepared it, we consulted and we had a list of acceptable species.
Okay, so if someone was landscaping a private site next to a road, you would expect, if an applicant were to follow this guidance, that the council would also be likely, through its own processes, to have a complementary or likely to have a complementary suite of species and what have you?
Potentially, but this suite has plants in there that require a higher level of formation.
Oh, Sure.
You know, well, the council ones typically will have a lower level.
Why is that?
Just maintenance costs.
Mm. Do applicants not have the same ability to then say, why can't I have cheaper maintenance costs? You've kind of walked into that one, I think.
Yeah, well they do, and that's sometimes, unfortunately, but we like to start up here, try and promote a good outcome, and whether it actually happens is...
Just not from the council.
Well, we try with them as well.
just move on. Let's, although there are two councillors here that might want to take that up with you. So we'll just do the same quickly through the residential guideline, but we'll be quicker. That's a note to my colleagues, not you.
Yes, I got that message. Thank you.
Help me understand on page 5 of the residential guideline, and this is just a question of between the versions. Step 3 still talks about a design statement. Is that just an unintended tweak to be made still, or are we still saying you'd think it's a great thing if people want to do it?
Yes, in my rebuttal, we altered that wording, but we didn't, attach in.
Well caught, Devlin. Good answer.
I just wanted to be on the same page. Because my first version of your evidence, your 42A, didn't have the guidelines attached. So I've been a bit uncertain that I actually had the up-to-date one. Rightio. So then, start with page 8. And we've already had the discussion about, in this context, whether these are good, bad, or otherwise. I'm interested in the right-hand column middle photograph. That's the white houses.
Yes.
Yep. So I see a lot of garage doors. I see a single window upstairs. I don't really see much else going on. And the photo below it, reasonably similar, although with larger areas of glazing, probably a living room onto a balcony upstairs. Those are what you'd see as okay.
You see, I guess in that middle photo, what you don't see is that they have a glass front door and side light, so there is a good interaction between the street. Obviously, there's some aspects that are not ideal, but again, it's just showing the bulk and form as well of what would be expected in this zone in terms of the topology.
So if we go into page 10 and the top photo in the right hand column, and we've got the garage, recessed door, and a couple of vertical slit windows in that front. That's also in the kind of acceptable category?
Yes, I think so. It's realistic in terms of what we get in a lot of low density.
So does that gel with your answer that you gave in respect of the landscape approach in the mixed use zone, where you said you want to start high and then work down? The answers you've given me now are much more, well, this is just more about the pragmatic
middle
ground.
It's always a balance.
Yeah.
And looking at the, you know, the lot layout.
Yeah.
And what existing...
So how does a user of the guide know when the imagery used is promoting the best use idealistic outcome versus when it might be much more of a, this is the result of an arm wrestle, that might not be what you should come in with to start with, or treat as an ideal that you then work down from?
Maybe it's similar to the previous one we were suggesting, adding labels to those photos to show,
maybe.
What we're trying to achieve.
And then if we go to page 14, actually, we'll do 13. Photograph 4. Again, I'm looking at a pretty long, flat building with reasonably sparse windows. Is that more practical, real world something in the middle as you see it, or am I missing that?
It's a bit of both. There's obviously some not some great aspects, but there's some good aspects in there as well in terms of having an open frontage.
So can we then go to the next page, 14, and photograph 3 that's got the cross on it. That has a level of glazing not dissimilar from the examples you've said are okay. Garage doors recessed back a bit, like the examples you said are okay. Okay, it's got a bit of a long side wall. I don't know what that's onto, whether it's a street or a lane. So the question is, there seems to be a bit of muddy overlap between photos that are okay and photos that aren't, and it's not been clear to me what specific defect the photo on page 14 has that some of the other examples couldn't be just as equally accused of suffering from.
Yeah. That one's the end black wall being end wall being blank. But again, maybe that is an aspect we could
write a little caption or something.
Yeah,
that just
exactly.
Said,
that just
this
the
is
one
the problem.
One liner. That's
okay.
The problem.
And as I look at a lot of these, especially the multi-unit ones, I'm seeing a lot of the same shapes, the same heights, the same forms. I'm not really seeing the diversity and variation you talked about between units that you suggested was covered earlier. And in fact, on element one, housing diversity and adaptability, talks more about the text, talks more about housing types and size of houses rather than the design of facades and buildings being varied. Am I missing something?
So element one is really talking about the building type and the unit size, and that what we're trying to encourage is that, especially in the medium and high density, that there is a variation in unit type, that say they're not all three-bedroom dwellings, so they have a mix of one, two, and three-bedroom.
When I was looking at this element, I had read and had in mind, now I need to find it, one of the medium density residential zone policies. And when I find it, I'll tell you what it is and take you to it. And although in the context of visual dominance effects, talks about ensure developments, etc., etc., through variation in facades and materials and roof form and building separation and recessions and other techniques. And you're satisfied that in the commentary you've given in the guideline that's reflected?
Yes, but not until, I think that one's covered more in element three.
Yep, no, not in terms of element one, just more royally.
Oh, yes, yep.
You're satisfied, it's there. Do you want to take us to element three then, and just take us through that?
So element three is looking at building dominance and sunlight access. And then this is one of the few occasions where we do repeat some of the standards of the district plan, but we've got some illustrations showing the recession planes.
Yeah, but that seems more poised around building form and shape rather than variation in facades and materials and the other things that policy I just took you to talk about.
Yes.
Okay. Pages 18 and 19. And I see the example seen negatively, which I understand is effectively the solid barrier around the edge of the space, primarily, it would seem.
Yes. Yep.
And then the diagram on the next page showing the more visually porous connection. Doesn't this issue inherently relate to and potentially conflict with the issue of privacy? At the end of the day, isn't the design issue whether people choose to put their private outdoor spaces right next to a public space and then create the demand for some kind of screen to give themselves privacy from users of the space, which the guide doesn't really address in terms of how people should think about just laying things out on sites to avoid having to have no privacy by having a visually transparent fence such as the diagram in page 19 shows, and which I would imagine someone would use against the council to say that that doesn't provide them any privacy. For instance, when I looked at your diagram on page 27, that shows what I would say is a more textbook outdoor space at the back, out of public view, along with the car parks. But nowhere in the guideline do you actually make those really basic, try to avoid these design conflicts to start with, rather than set up a contest between the different elements in the resource consent.
Yeah.
Is that a fair comment?
Yes and no. It's always a bit of education. But it is always that balance between privacy and passive surveillance over communal areas or public space. We do in some other design guides. We do have diagrams that show sort of layout and what's possible and what's not. It was just in this one we decided to try to do with photos and sketches.
Yeah, sure. Diagram on page 23. And I appreciate this is addressing an element talking about high levels of accessibility. But when I look at what you've drawn there, it seems to show a lot of the things that the photos throughout the guideline you've said are bad, including a high frequency of garages and car parking across the footpath, very minimal windows facing the street, maybe brightly coloured front doors. And if this was designed as a rear service lane, I could get it.
Yep.
But it's not. You've designed it as the street with letterboxes and footpaths on it. And so again, I'm probably fair to say I'm struggling a little bit when I look at the guideline as a whole to get a really consistent view of what it's actually saying I shouldn't be doing and what I should do. Because I would expect someone would use the diagram whenever the council raised concerns about garages and car parks and all the other things the guideline talks about. They'd just use your own diagram and say, but the diagram says it's okay.
Yeah.
Wouldn't they?
This type of development's common. There's a lot of this through, you know, say Hobsonville, very similar ilk. We've tried to show that, you know, the front doors are clearly visible from the street. The garage doors set back enough, and there is some glazing facing over the lane. Also, that the end unit addresses the street.
So let's look at your element B on that list. Large expanses of hard stand area for vehicles, especially for media adjoining, da-di-da-di-da-di-da.
Yeah.
You kind of said elsewhere in the guideline, don't do that. But now you're saying it's okay as long as you have some landscaping. So what is the guideline as a whole asking people to do?
I think about it in terms of the design process.
But do you think that's fair when an applicant takes a mixed bag approach, thinks about it, proposes something, and then the council officer says, no, you've got it wrong. We think you should be doing something totally different.
No, I think, I work on both sides, and, you know, I do have that from the council as well. I think it's the discussion that's the important aspect, and I think that the key bit we're trying to get across is that they've looked at their design holistically, and they haven't, you know, there's aspects that they leave out.
Okay. Page 22, middle photograph, right hand row. And notwithstanding the merits of the caption, I might actually just ask you what specifically were you suggesting that was doing well?
There's tree planting, and they've tried to screen the bins, and they do have car parking in front of the garages, there's sufficient space there that they're not overhanging the footpath.
Page 24, it would be middle row, middle photograph. So it's the photograph below the one that has a cross on it. Yep, with me?
Apologies, I thought you were actually talking about that on the last.
Huh? No, no, I wasn't. I was talking about page 22 and the rear lane example from Hobsonville.
Yes, yeah. So back to your previous question, that the good aspect there is that actually the garages are provided at the back rather than on the main street frontage.
Yeah, no, I took you there as a direct rebuttal to your diagram on page 23, which is more reflective of what Hobsonville actually shows. But page 24, middle row, middle photograph. This is the photograph of all of them that has lots of landscaping on it.
Yes.
So the topic is how to integrate waste and service areas. I'm just seeing a landscaped front fence on a street within which the bin sits inside a front yard. So other than lots of landscaping, what's it doing that's desirable?
Well, ideally you wouldn't see the bins. I guess that's the intention. You can see them just in the bottom sort of
yeah, that almost ingenious cropping.
Yeah. I think that's unfortunate, it's just the way the photo is.
Shouldn't the photo have been focused on the waste bin, not the landscaping? If that photo is about the bin?
It comes back to your question too about the storage area and the mesh door, that because it's so zoomed in, it doesn't actually show what's intended. And so potentially by showing the complete frontage.
Yes, no, it's an occupational hazard of urban designers is being too enthusiastic showing people the full frontage.
Yeah.
But on that bad joke, you'll be pleased to know that's my questions. Thank you both for tag teaming and bouncing back and forth. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Robertson, are we at morning tea? Well, I think it'd be a good time for a break for 15 minutes.